Tom Weber on NPR News. All right, here's a pop quiz. It's actually not much of a pop quiz because I'm going to give the answer pretty quickly after that. But shout the answer out to your radio or your computer or your phone. Which performer christened the venue now known as First Avenue in its inaugural show in 1970? Yell the answer right now at the radio. Two more seconds. Okay, here's the answer.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears.
Ah, the late Joe Cocker. It's one of those factoids that Minnesota music heads must know. This is music, Minnesota music trivia 101 kind of stuff. And yet, Joe Cocker himself didn't remember the gig when he was asked about it in the 2000s. Chris Riemenschneider has gathered that and scores of other memories into a new book about First Ave and what was there before First Ave. The book is called First Avenue, Minnesota's Main Room. Riemenschneider is a longtime Star Tribune music writer and critic. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Call in now with your most memorable moment at First Ave. What show? Maybe it wasn't even a show. What was the best memory? We're sharing those this hour. 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1, and don't call or text if you're driving. Did I understand there were dogs on stage for Joe Cocker?
They had a dog. Dogs and children were part of the touring entourage of the 1970 Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour.
It was a different time, wasn't it?
It was. It was. Well, and for that to be the club's first opening show, it was like one of the, you know, most troublesome tours they probably could opted to open with.
And they were pretty demanding. It was two shows one night, and it was a pretty demanding band.
It was actually two shows two nights.
Oh, two shows two nights. Yeah,
which actually a lot of bands did back in those days. But halfway through, they did the first show, and between the first show and the second show on opening night, you know, this is a newbie club owner. The manager of Joe Cocker came, the tour manager, came and said, "We're not playing if we don't get more money."
Is that still happen a lot today?
I don't think they get away with that in this day and age. No,
contracts.
Yeah,
and
things
stuff
are pretty
and
well,
that.
Pretty well.
Wow.
Sewn
well,
up
Joe Cocker
that.
Was riding high though. I mean, it was a bit of a score.
It was right after the Woodstock movie came out, and there was a video crew, a film crew following Cocker around, almost, you know, to seize on the opportunity of Woodstock, and so there is footage. There's a Mad Dogs and Englishmen documentary on that tour, and there is video in there. The song "The Letter," which is an old Box Tops hit that he did, great song. If you watch that, you can see it's from First Avenue. You know this because there's carnations all over the place. It was opening night, and they brought in like 2,000 carnations. But also, it pans to the audience, and it's unmistakable that It's still the same venue.
It's that same view, same look.
Hasn't changed a whole lot.
With the loft and the second floor there.
Yeah.
1-800-242-2828. Share your favorite memory of First Ave. If you've gone since, what, 01 you moved here? If you've been there since 01.
I grew up here, actually, and then went away for 12 years. So
and then
I
came back.
Had two different eras there, yeah.
I think most people, especially the music heads, Chris, will know that it was a Greyhound bus station before it was First Ave.
Yeah, and actually, technically, you might want to say the first act that performed there was on opening day of the Greyhound Bus Depot in 1937. It was the Gophers Men's Orchestra or something like that.
Well, so, let's get them back to First Ave.
Exactly, exactly.
So what was so that's another piece of trivia that we all know, the Greyhound Bus Depot. What was there before the depot? You actually get into the history of that corner.
Yeah, well, there's actually, it comes up in the ghost stories section of the book because there's a lot of ghost paranormal activity in the club. It was apparently there was like a slaughterhouse and like, which is hilarious to think about, but that it was still a rural enough town that downtown area had cattle on it, and supposedly they hear sheep and cows and ghosts
to this day.
Yes.
Wow.
Could be drunk people hanging out,
mooing
out. Yeah.
Somewhere in the past. So how did it get to be from a bus station to a music venue?
You know, it sat empty for a while, and Ted Mann, who owned he owned the theaters downtown. They still, the Mann Theater chain is still in town. They owned the Pantages and the Orpheum in those days. And so we're not quite sure. I even talked to some of the Mann family. We couldn't quite figure out how. It was like just a deal where they got like the whole block of real estate after the depot the bus depot closed. It was closed for about 2 years. And these kids, one of whom was the primary one, was a Finger Hut family kid of the Finger Hut Corporation, a rich kid, 26 years old. Hey, I'm going to open a rock club. And they landed at the there was this complex story of how they got the liquor license, because liquor licenses were hard to come by in those days. And they kind of combined their forces. And they say the guys who were involved in the opening of it, I mean, they had to do a little work, but they said it was almost as if it was meant to be a rock club from the get-go.
So is that a is that almost a demoralizing story to know that it was actually started because a rich kid wanted to play with dad's money?
Well, yeah, I don't think it would have lasted as nearly as long. He went into the hole from the get-go.
Yeah.
So it probably could have shut down.
So he got his coming to him for that. He learned how to be a businessman one way or another.
He did, yes.
So you have, and the other thing though, it was a bus station of yore. It wasn't like you see with Greyhound stops today, which are sometime in the, you know, in like a parking lot or something. I mean, there was like a barber shop and stuff in there.
It was really a ornate complex. I mean, there's some great photos in the book of you know what's now the 7th Street entry. This dark, dingy nightclub. Mm-hmm. The photo in there of it was the restaurant of the depot, and it's like this super high polished, bright sunlit cafe.
7th Street Entry was the restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Compared to what it is now.
Yeah, it's
you
not.
You want eat a thing.
No, don't. Yeah. You drink the beer, but yeah. don't eat any of the food there. We're taking your memories as well from First Avenue. What are your favorite memories? Chris Riemenschneider here. His book is called First Avenue, Minnesota's Main Room. The launch of it, the official book launch, is Sunday. It's on a Sunday, November 12th. You couldn't get a better night at First Ave.
They're too booked up.
It's actually at 7th Street Entry, so you'll be in the restaurant. Bring your own food, right?
Yeah, right.
Taking your calls as well. Scott in Minneapolis, favorite memory, First Ave. Hi, go ahead.
Well, I was lucky enough to have a brother that worked there, and so he was able to sneak me into shows when I was a kid, and he snuck me in to see U2 in 79. I was very lucky. I think I have the year right. I'm not 100% positive.
It was 81, right?
It was 81. Yeah, yeah. Right as Boy was coming out, their first record. They wound up playing there twice, which was it was pretty remarkable. And
so, and you actually give a couple pages just to you too.
Yeah, that's a big moment. You know, Bono at US Bank Stadium this past summer even harked back to from the stage. Yeah, yeah. He said something about remembering seeing us at those who remember seeing us at Uncle Sam's.
Because, and let's do that. Let's the list of what First Avenue was before its First Avenue.
Yeah, it started as a depot, 2 years as a depot. Really cool rock club, hosted all these legendary acts, starting with Joe Cocker. And then it became a disco club called Uncle Sam's for pretty much through the heyday of the disco era from 72 to 79. Transitioned into Sam's, which was sort of between the dance club and the rock club that we know now, and then First Avenue as of the beginning of 1982.
Well, we have a little piece of music. We're going to play that first piece talking about the disco era. Lips Incorporated.
Yeah.
Little Funky Town for you. It's so hard to think of it as a disco place.
It is. And it wasn't even like not a cool Studio 54 kind of disco place. It was kind of, cheesy polyester and kids from the suburbs coming in. And the drinking age at that point was 18.
In Minnesota.
Yeah. And that was just a huge boon to the club, of course.
So when it was disco, it was Uncle Sam's. What's a danceteria?
There was a place in New York that used that term and they kind of stole it. The idea being like a cafeteria, you can get all kinds of food, so you can get all kinds of dance music in there was kind of the gist.
So So it was a disco place. That's when you two played?
They played as it was transitioning from – it was actually Sam's when they played.
They took off Uncle.
Yeah, yeah. That was when there was a company, outside company was running it. Alan Fingerhead still had owned the lease and whatnot and liquor license. But this outside company from Cincinnati had these chain of disco clubs around in like blue-collar towns like Buffalo, New York, and Davenport, Iowa. Kind of an interesting history there, and they finally pulled out as disco was dying, and the manager at the time was this guy named Steve McClellan, who would very basically carry the place. Promised Alan Fingerhut they wouldn't lose money, which wasn't really true,
which was a lie.
Alan himself didn't lose money in the deal, and they started bringing in these cooler rock acts,
including
you too, exactly. Yeah,
I've always I'm still waiting for the day that one of my friends gets married and plays for their first dance. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. I just think that would be the best song to see if anybody gets the joke. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Yeah. We're taking your calls as well. Carrie in Minnetonka, what's your favorite memory of First Ave?
Well, actually, it's funny. I was thinking when you said, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. My best friend used to say, oh, I want a paler shade of gray played at my funeral. So that made me kind of laugh. However, my favorite memory was we went to see a band called Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians, or at least we had tickets for it. Probably was mid-80s. And they didn't show up, and they had this band called The Replacements to replace them. And we were all like, what? Oh, what? You know, so we stuck around, and it was The Replacements. And it was a great show, really, really cool.
Is that why they have their name, Chris?
No, I just wanted to see. No, but that is a funny coincidence. No, that is a great story. And they were, Robin at the time was recording for Twin Tone Records, and The Replacements obviously were on Twin Tone Records too. So they were label mates, so they stepped up. The Replacements had some, you know, obviously they had their own great shows there, and well, actually they had many not so great shows there, kind of many disastrous shows there. But Paul Westerberg played what was then his one and only solo acoustic show. That's the Replacements frontman, opening for Jorma Kekauen of Jefferson Airplane.
Wow.
It was just kind of weird,
that's
Bill,
so
but it was a really kind of formative thing for Paul Westerberg to do, and that's in the book too.
The book is called First Avenue, Minnesota's Main Room. Chris Riemenschneider, who writes for the Star Trib and has been to, you have any idea how many shows you've been to at First Avenue?
I figured it's near 1,000.
You're getting on 1,000.
Yeah,
they should have Chris Day or something when you hit 1,000.
Listen,
you know?
there are people that are there a lot more than that. There are people that live there practically.
We're listening and hearing from your memories as well. Dylan on Twitter says, I saw They Might Be Giants twice at First Ave. It's such an intimate venue. I'll probably go again this spring. Paul Simon did a concert. I see Dave on email says, and then Curtis A. did the John Lennon tribute concert.
Yeah, he does that every year. The Paul Simon was an interesting one because that was just that was maybe 2014. That was obviously a real big get for them. And that was, I think that was Paul wanting to play this legendary venue. I really do, because he obviously can do bigger places than that. And that, it was really a cool show. And
that was my sense too, right? I mean, yeah. I don't know if he's selling out arenas anymore.
No, but he can do fancier theaters. It was nice because, all the Graceland stuff and whatnot, you want to dance to that, and you can't do that in the theater. And so that was, one case where people were really dancing at a Paul Simon show.
Well,
great.
Speaking of Curtis A here, here's a little Curtis A. He's going to be actually playing Sunday at your book launch at 7th Street.
Yeah, he opened 7th Street Entry. That's why he's playing. I mean, he's awesome, too.
Oh,
that's why
cool.
He's playing it, too. But
mm-hmm. Before we had Born in the USA,
yeah,
we had Land of the Free by Curtis Ayres.
Now it still rings. There's some truth to that song today. Yeah.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Kurt is actually maybe has played the club more than anyone else because he goes all the way back to the Depot era. He opened for his band at the time opened for Country Joe of Country Joe and the Fish.
Wow.
Also another Woodstock act. And he's, you know, he played this opening night of 7th Street Entry, which was March 1980, and kept playing, and he's still plays every year for the Lennon Tribute, which is one of my favorite nights at the club every year. It's a beautiful event.
And he'll be there Sunday for your thing as for the book event. Did it ever try to be specific kind of music? I know disco, right? Taking away the disco, was it trying to be punk? Was it trying to be this? Was it trying to be that ever?
No, and that's that. I mean, obviously, that's really, I think, been a key to his success. And really, even going back to the Depot era, had everything from they had blues acts. B.B. King played there. They had Ike and Tina play there.
Yeah.
You know, but also they had punk rock in 1971. Iggy and the Stooges played there. You know, it doesn't get much cooler than that. And then really, especially in the early 80s, obviously that's when Prince came in. Mm-hmm. But not only was Prince emblematic of that diversity, but Steve McClellan brought in. He would bring in these African acts and these jazz acts that, you know, were kind of literally and figuratively foreign to the rock crowds, and these hip rock kids would still show up, and you'll see Sun Ra and people who saw stuff like that are, you know, still rave about it to this day.
Brenda Colton said that she saw Tina Turner.
Yeah,
back in the, that had to be so memorable. That was before she hit her thing, or was she?
Tina has a real colorful history too, because she played there with Ike in 71, and then before she had her comeback, she played there. I think it was 3 times, and she even after when What's Love Got to Do with It was taking off, she played there again. Kind of as a thanks to them having her there, and she rocked the place. Everybody, and this was when she was still kind of playing kitschy kind of casino venues and whatnot, and so it was hinted at how cool she would become at her great comeback.
Yeah, let's go to Drew in Mankato. What's your memory here for Chris Riemenschneider, Drew?
Oh, hi. Yeah, I've been enjoying listening to you. My first year out of high school. 1975, moved up to go to the University of Minnesota. And some of us guys would go down there, I believe it was Uncle Sam's, and it was a big discotheque. The floor had, you know, chunks of lighting that would light up different directions as you danced up, and it was all like a plexiglass floor, and there's like 3 tiers down to the floor with a railing around it. And then there was a guy up on the stage with a big drum set, double bass drum set, and he would play along with the disco music, you know, when you dance with people. And I was introduced to a drink at the age of 18 that was called a White Russian. I just loved it.
Very good, Drew. Thanks for the call. I mean, that's
a perfect memory of that era because there's a lot of drinking and the dance, the drummers playing to the dance records. That was their version of live music, was having the live drummers. Lo and behold, one of those drummers was future Prince and the Revolution drummer Bobby Z.
Wow.
Got his first time playing the club was playing along to disco records.
Because it was just to be there to be something live while they play
the
disco music. Yeah. Paul wrote in and said back in the early 80s, working for CCO, they were taping something at first to have some performance. I don't remember who was performing. I'm reading this email. But my big memory was seeing Bob Dylan leaning against the back wall at 7th Street Entry, listening to the band on stage. No one seemed to notice Mr. Dylan.
Yeah, we have in the book what I believe is the one and only photo of Bob Dylan in that venue. I'm not sure if it's that same show, because he did show up there. Going back to the Depot era, he would just show up and hang out. The one photo we have is Babes in Toyland drummer Lori Barbero, who was really integral to that club. She hung out there and played there. She snapped a kind of incognito photo of him in a blue Hawaiian shirt. Just seeing this band called the Alley Cats were kind of a footnote. It's cool to know he hung out there. I never played there. They had him booked in about 2005. Maybe it was 2003, 2005. Got so close to having him there that they actually had printed up tickets for the show. And then he backed out.
So he's never played?
No, never.
Well, speaking of Babes in Toyland, here's a little music. My thing, you know, I use my voice for a living, Chris. I don't get the shrieking and how you can do it night after night singing.
That'll wake up your listeners tuning in to hear about what's going on in their precinct or whatever.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. A little Babes in Toyland there. I mean, so many bands.
Yeah, they were one of the great local bands to
just get their start.
Yeah, yeah. There's a story of them playing the 7th Street Entry and they playing their Beyond when they were too big to play there. And They had a lot of young girls in their audience, which was, you know, is awesome because these girls at that point didn't have a lot of young women rockers to look up to, and they were able to pack in supposedly about 600 people in 7th Street Entry, which has a legal capacity of 250.
Whoa!
But it's because it was these you know, short petite young girls.
They thought they could cheat that.
Yeah, yeah. But that's also indicative of how big they were at the time.
Do you have a documented list of every time First Ave broke the fire code?
Oh, God. Yeah, you know, it's interesting that they, I mean, those early Depot shows were, they would get 2,000 people in there. Wow. And the place only, the capacity now is 1,500. So imagine.
How did you want to shape this book or not shape it around Prince?
You know, that's a great question. As I started going into this, I actually kind of wanted to downplay Prince. And the reason is because everybody knows it as Prince's place. And I wanted to say, no, there's so much more history here.
Mm-hmm.
As I was going along, I got so many great stories. And I understood a lot more about his connection to the club because I wasn't around for any of that. I only saw him there in he did the 7707 show in 2007.
Right.
But I understand it was a much deeper connection than, I mean, he played their 9 full shows, which isn't a lot. But each of those 9 shows were really unique and really kind of important stepping stone moments for him. You know, the foremost being when he debuted and recorded Purple Rain and 2 other songs that would wind up on the Purple Rain album. But then, so I was already building up to it, and then lo and behold, halfway through the writing of it, he passed away.
Yeah. This picture on page 93 of Prince at a show, and I don't know if this is at Sam's, when it was called Sam's or not, but
that would have been First Ave by then.
He has the boots on with the heels, and there's the black duct tape. Did you notice that in the photo?
No.
Here, I'm going to show you this. It's this amazing, here, grab the book. Go ahead. It's that photo there. See that black duct tape, like, yeah, around his heels?
Yeah.
That's an incredible detail to have in an old photo of Prince.
Yeah, you wouldn't see him doing duct tape in the later days.
That's true.
Designer duct tape.
And then he recorded, obviously, Purple Rain, but then let's just get this song in there, too, Baby, I'm a Star. I didn't realize, you know, you hear it, but yeah. I didn't realize that was recorded at First Ave. I'm a Star. Did anyone have a? I mean, you filmed the movie there. Like, how do you navigate when he was hitting stardom with the album, when the movie was coming out, and when First Avenue was going to have those ramifications? I mean, was anyone able to measure the tsunami?
Yeah, no. It's when he played there and his first show there, which was when it was still Sam's, was in 1981. It was right after. It was about two, three weeks after he played Saturday Night Live. And it was right when he was really starting to break nationally. And up to that point, he hadn't really played to hadn't had a good show in his hometown.
Oh, he hadn't?
No. He played the Orpheum a year earlier, and it was half full. And
really?
Yeah, it wasn't that great of a show.
A Prince show in Minneapolis
exactly.
That was half full?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And so it, but part of that is, you know, some people cynically say, you know, people in Minneapolis, you have to go and have success somewhere else before we'll take you seriously here. But it was a little more than that. It was, you know, him playing in theaters, as we were talking about earlier, you know, you want to dance to it at a Prince show. And he finally had this big open dance floor to play in town. And just the diverse nature of the audience, which really became, you know, what the place was in the early 80s was this diverse urban crowd. You know, that was obviously spoke to him. And there's a really colorful history. There's another new book out by Andrew Swenson from 89 Through the Current, Got to Be Something Here, that talks about the history of the African-American R&B and soul bands in town in the 60s and 70s. And they couldn't play downtown.
Yeah.
They basically were banned unofficially from playing downtown. So for Prince from the North Side to get to play the biggest place in town, downtown, was a big deal.
You can find that interview with Andrea she did with Kathy Werzer at nprnews.org about her book. Did you guys conspire to have your books out at the same time?
No. I think it's actually proved to be kind of a cool thing. But
Tad, actually, to your point about the open dance floor, Tad considers it the perfect venue. Is it the no seats? Is it the general admission? What is it? I don't know if you think it's the perfect venue, but what is it about First Ave that makes it work?
Yeah. There's a lot of different things that make it so great. The open dance floor, back in those days, it was kind of a unique thing in 1970 to have a venue like that where the hippies wanted to dance.
Yeah.
And they certainly did there. The design of the depot itself really unknowingly accommodated the acoustics of the place, because there's these curved walls. We all know the curved front wall.
Yeah.
Well, behind the stage, there's also a curved wall, which was the gates that you would go out to the garage to your buses afterwards. That makes for great acoustics. It's like a natural, I don't know the technical term.
It just works.
Yeah, it just works. So it's just naturally a great sounding room, too. The one really big thing is the musicians like how they're treated there. The musicians, and I have heard this over and over from everybody I've talked to that's come into town that has played First Avenue or is about to play First Avenue. They like the way they're treated there. They feel like they respect the musicians there. There's a quote from Mark Perlman of the Jayhawks in there where, you know, he says, it's kind of rigorous and it's kind of grueling.
It's hell sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And then you pull into First Avenue and it's aesthetically, it's not comforting. It's really bare bones, not much to it. But there's a comfort level there that is in the way that the staff treats you. And I don't know, just being at this familiar place, you know, there's the musicians love it. And that, I think, adds to the performance that they give.
Chris Riemenschneider with me. The book is First Avenue, Minnesota's Main Room. We're taking your calls as well. Favorite memories. Marcus in Worthington, what would you share here today?
Actually, my memory is the opposite of a favorite memory. It's actually one of the it's a worst memory with an interesting ending. For the past 20-some years, I've been a real Prince fan. But in the early to mid-80s, I did not enjoy his music. I attended a small college in Northeast Iowa, and my girlfriend, thankfully, became my wife and still married after this mishap on my part. She surprised me with two tickets to see Prince at, I believe it was called First Avenue, in about 85. And I said, I am absolutely not going to that concert. Oh. And I didn't go, and she went by herself.
Oh, no. And,
so my memory of First Avenue is actually, what a bonehead I am.
Oh, man. Marcus, I got nothing for you. That was an idiotic move.
Your wife can forever have break against you.
Yeah, she'll lord that over you for sure. But thanks for calling, Marcus. Let's go to David in St. Louis Park. Hi, David. Your favorite memory.
Well, good morning. I'm looking forward to the book. The tweets have been very interesting. People should know that you can tour First Avenue. I did that this spring, and Daniel Corrigan, the photographer, took us around. It was a great treat. A small anecdote. Years ago, when you left the place, they used to shove into your hand a little packet of tickets for upcoming shows, and so you could come back and visit. And I saw a lot of shows as freebies that way, including Cyndi Lauper, who I never would have expected to enjoy as much as I did, but my all-time favorite is Ray Charles. Being able to be 10 or 15 feet away from Ray Charles and the Raelettes was an absolute treat.
I can't.
Not it's old building Congress with First Avenue, but it was a great show.
I couldn't imagine being that close to Ray Charles.
No, that's one of the legendary shows in the early 80s. That was McClellan and Chrissy Dunlop was another booker there. They loved those kind of acts. And these were acts that were kind of playing kitschy supper club kind of places, yeah. And to have them at a cool rock club was.
And yet, for all of these memories, you talk about and you've talked in all your interviews about how of a much of a sliver it was operating on. It could have closed 70 times in its existence.
Yeah. When they changed over from the Uncle Sam's to transition into Sam's to First Avenue, they actually started in the hole because the company that was running it, this Cincinnati company that was running Uncle Sam's, left them with like about $60,000 in debt. And they started in the hole. They never really got out of it. Steve McClellan and his longtime partner, kind of more the numbers guy, Jack Myers, they were working for nothing for many years and sleeping on the couch. McClellan slept on the couch and worked there around the clock, basically. And so it's kudos to those guys for keeping it alive as long as they did. Lo and behold, the ownership situation came to a head in 2004, and there was this bankruptcy battle that shut it down, and we were all scared to death that we were going to lose the
place.
It
was close for a few weeks.
It was 3 weeks, just under 3 weeks. And it didn't look good. But they reopened, and since then, they've turned a profit every year.
The last chapter, actually, you talk about 2005 to now is actually the heyday.
Yeah.
The real heyday. You think of all these memories, you're saying, nope, actually right now is the heyday.
Yeah. If financially, you can't argue it because, they're doing better than they ever have. They've expanded into they own the Turf Club in St. Paul now. They run the Palace Theater down here in St. Paul. They're a little mini empire. In a good way. You can't argue with that. Creatively, I think they're just still doing great. The musicians that play there, there's still a lot of incredible stuff going on there.
I'm gonna play this song.
I'm not a woman. I'm not a man. I am something that you'll never understand. I'll never reach you.
That's Pavel.
Yeah.
The Night Prince Died,
which
opens your book.
Yeah. Yeah, an amazing
that
moment.
That street concert right outside of First Avenue.
An amazing moment, not just in First Avenue history. I think in Minnesota history, that is just a defining moment of our generation.
I was there. It was incredible.
It was incredible. It's just this beautiful mixture of joy, and we were all so sad, but at the same time, God, this music is so uplifting. And the fact that they were able to put that together, mm-hmm. and the city went along with it just speaks to their influence in this town, and that so many people showed up, speaks obviously to Prince's greatness, but people recognize that this is a place to be. This is ground zero for
us. I discovered Pavel that night. I said, "Who is
that?" Oh man!
That?
Well, yeah, she should be packing that club any day now too. As far as I'm concerned, she's incredible. Yeah.
The book is First Avenue, Minnesota's Main Room, on Sunday at 7th Street Entry. Tickets available. The book launch. Curtis A is going to be there. A few other performers as well. And you were telling me before we started here in the last few minutes, you haven't gotten people complaining yet that you left out anything. It's a really big book. It makes a nice knock when you drop it on the table there.
Yeah, no, I'm lugging them around now. My back's going out. There's going to be people that are going to, why didn't you include this show? Why didn't you include that show? There was too much to include, people. It's 47 years of history. I tried to whittle it down to stuff that kind of fit the different narratives and everything. There's so many. I personally have so many great memories that aren't in there. I just went with what told the story best, I thought.
Well, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Chris Riemann-Schneider from the Star Trib. The book is First Avenue, Minnesota's Main Room, and if you won't play it at your wedding, we'll play it here.